Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today, we continue discussing this political moment by speaking with a few members of the 92%. The 92% refers to the Black women who voted for Kamala Harris for president. Black women regularly vote for Democrats, even when they disagree on major issues. Many say it's a vote for the collective good. A few weeks ago, one of our callers, a Black woman, said she noticed that the recent No Kings protests were overwhelmingly white, and she wondered if organizers did enough outreach in the Black community. So we did some research and ran across a great piece in the 19th by Erin Haynes called We Don't Have an Option Not to Fight, How Black Women Are Resisting Now. Erin Haynes writes, in the early days of the Trump administration, there have been feelings of anger, resolve, resignation, and exhaustion among Black women and many other Americans frustrated with Trump's actions and the current political climate. In early April, millions of protesters took to the streets in cities across the country to make their voices heard. The crowds were overwhelmingly white, not the typical makeup of other recent protest movements. Many of the Black women who've been among the leaders of such movements in the past decade were noticeably and intentionally absent. Erin Haynes goes on to write, the Black women I talk to say they're being strategic, pragmatic, and creative about what their resistance looks like now, preparing for the long fight ahead, and rejecting narratives that suggest their lack of visibility in this moment translates into inaction. So how are Black women activists thinking about this political moment, what effective activism and organizing looks like, and where we go from here? Today, we're joined by three guests. Melanie Campbell is president and CEO of the National Coalition on Black Civic Participation and convener of the Black Women's Roundtable. Melanie Campbell has served as an advisor to U.S. presidents, congressional members, labor, nonprofit execs, faith leaders, and others on critical issues impacting Black America. Hi, Melanie. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the invitation, Rose.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Judith Brown Dionysus. Judith is executive director of the Advancement Project. She leads their work in combating structural racism in education, voting, policing, criminal justice, and immigration. Judith Brown Dionysus served as a lawyer, professor, and civil rights advocate in the movement for racial justice. Hi, Judith. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you, Rose, for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Adrienne Shropshire, Executive Director of Black PAC and the affiliated Black Progressive Action Coalition. Adrienne oversees Black PAC's research and political strategy, coordinating with grassroots community organizations and states across the country. Adrienne began her political work as a community organizer here in California, where she organized South Los Angeles neighborhoods around police accountability, economic justice, and youth empowerment. Hi, Adrienne. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you, Rose.
Well, thank you all for joining us. There's just so much going on. We've done a couple of shows about Medicaid cuts. And Ebony had a really important piece called House Passed Tax Legislation on Track to Hit Black Women Where It Hurts. What a headline. There are a lot of articles, of course, about Trump going after and trying to erase Black history. The New York Times, ProPublica had a piece a couple weeks ago, dismissed by DEI. Trump's purge made Black women with stable federal jobs an easy target. You know, I'm sorry to start the show like this, but this is what we're dealing with right now. I wonder how you all have been processing what's happening over the past 6 months and what you're making of this political moment. Melanie, let's start with you.
Okay. Thank you, Rose. First of all, it's great to be on with my sisters, Judith and Adrienne. You kind of laid it out when you talked about Erin Haynes' article that she wrote recently. Bottom line is we are organizing and we are strategizing. We never stopped. But we also understand that this is a different moment and that there are certain things that part of that strategy has to be driven by others in some ways. How we organize, how we strategize is not something we're going to be putting out on a press release every time we do something either, because it's a different moment. And so, but also knowing that when you look at, you talked about 92%, we voted, we tried to tell America, right? So part of this has to go through the process of what we're going through so that we don't find ourselves in this mess, hopefully in the near future, but it could be longer. As African-Americans, we've always had to address forward progress with a major backlash. If you think historically, which we've done some of that analysis of thinking historically about where we are, how do we get here? We've been here before, but in different ways. If we talk about the first Reconstruction coming out of slavery in this country, we were able to come out. Then you had decades of Jim Crow rule. Then if you think about the 50s and 60s, the second Reconstruction, you had the Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Act, fair housing, like any other, and then a retrenchment from a lot of those gains that were made, and believe that part of what we're going through now is a backlash as far back as when President Obama was elected. First African-American, then had the audacity for this country to elect a Black South Asian woman, and here again. And the underlying part of that is still the unfinished reality about race, how race plays in this country. And so we're also making sure that we take care of ourselves and look inwardly. Many of us have been involved with a State of Power People Tour that Angela Rye and others and Judy and folks put real hard work in. And we've been organizing on the ground. We've been still voting. Elections are still happening. And so the notion that because you don't see majority Black people at a protest does not mean we're not doing the work. Mm.
That is Melanie Campbell, president and CEO of the National Coalition on Black Civic Participation and convener of the Black Women's Roundtable. Judith, what would you like to add?
Yeah, I think Melanie, you know, explained a lot of it. I would add to that that this, like, the moment that the political moment that we are in is a continuation of decades of work that has been done on by right-wing operatives, right? So even if we think, you know, I'm a lawyer, so when I think about the attacks on the 14th Amendment, the attacks on affirmative action, the idea that we should be a colorblind society, which means that actually to those folks who are pushing colorblind society means that we actually should have no repair for historic discrimination and we should do away with affirmative action. So this didn't all start with the Trump administration. There have been decades of litigation that have sought to undermine and eviscerate fundamental protections that we find in the Constitution and the amendments to the Constitution. Then I would add to that that in this moment we have the dismantling of the federal government, which has, at least during the civil rights movement, often stepped in to protect Black people. And so we're seeing that those protections, like we cannot rely on a U.S. Department of Justice to protect Black people anymore. And we're seeing a consolidation of power in the White House, as well as the squashing of dissent. So that's what happens when an authoritarian regime comes into play, right? Is that dissent cannot be had. But I think from the perspective of Black women, to Melanie's point, like we are, you know, like I'm working hard, right? And we are all working hard doing the work of protecting our communities, of fighting back, and of building what comes on the other side of this administration. So, you know, I think that, you know, as far as like not seeing us on the streets, the other thing is for Black people, Black folks know that the consequences for us in protesting is ratcheted up. And so we may not see Black people taking to the streets in record numbers, but there are Black people who are out there. And that's, to me, what is important is that Black people are choosing to pick a lane. Am I going to do the protest work and the fight back work? Am I going to do the protect my community work? Or am I going to keep thinking about building a strong Black community?
That is Judith Brown, Diane Niss, Executive Director of the Advancement Project. Judith has served as a lawyer, professor, and civil rights advocate in the movement for racial justice. Adrian, what would you like to add?
Well, Judith and Melanie have taken all my thoughts. I think that we find ourselves in a moment that you laid out, Rose, and that Melanie and Judith have also laid out, just in terms of the sense and the feeling of being overwhelmed that I know that our communities face. And so whether it is, you know, the impact of, you know, federal jobs being eliminated that disproportionately affect Black folks, whether it is the, you know, insistence that we forget history, that we erase memory from, you know, from our schools, from our agencies, right? Whether it's the spending bill that will have a devastating impact on Black communities, whether it is immigration. And I sit here in Los Angeles where, you know, we are seeing people being kidnapped off of the streets. And we know that there is a significant number of Black immigrants here in Los Angeles that are being impacted. And we know that Black Americans who live in these neighborhoods are being impacted because there is an increased presence of law enforcement on their neighborhoods. Judith talked about the 14th Amendment and the attack on the 14th Amendment. And we've seen just in the last couple of days, the Supreme Court essentially, you know, take huge swipes at key provisions of the 14th Amendment, both due process and equal protection. And then tomorrow, I suppose, we'll be getting a ruling on birthright citizenship. So there is so much happening, and people feel so overwhelmed that I think that one of the things that's important and really, you know, speaks to what Judith was saying about people trying to figure out kind of where they fit in, what can they do, what do they have the ability to do, what is the lane that they should be in, is because people want to do something. They want to be engaged. They know that resistance is necessary. And sometimes it's hard for people to figure out what is the right thing for them to be doing, or feeling like doing something as small as calling your Congress member is not enough. And I think that that is the work that Black organizers are doing across the country right now. And that includes Black women who are leading many of the organizations, is helping people to find that lane, helping them to figure out what is the thing that they can do in this moment that makes them feel like they're taking part. And so that might be out at a protest, and it might not be. There are many ways for people to engage. And I think that there is some, I would say, resentment among among Black folks and Black organizers in particular about this idea that there's only one way that we can show resistance right now, and that is being at mass protests. And that simply is not true. It is not true now, nor has it ever been true in the history of social change in this country, that there is a single way to demonstrate opposition. And so I think that we are out now doing lots of work, helping communities make sense of what is happening right now, but also helping individual folks figure out what is the best way for them to engage in this moment.
Adrian Shropshire is Executive Director of Black PAC and the affiliated nonpartisan Black Progressive Action Coalition. Today on Your Call, we are speaking with Black women activists about this political moment, what effective activism and organizing looks like under a second Trump term, and where we go from here. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. You know, thinking about how Kamala Harris got 75 million votes, Trump got 77.3. So let's say about 3 million vote difference. And to think that 3 million votes could make such a difference in people's lives, to think that 90 million people did not vote this time, 90 million. And Kamala Harris got fewer votes than Joe Biden. I wonder how you're all thinking about this, because we heard from a lot of young people who were so angry at the Democratic Party about what was happening in Gaza. And so a lot of them did not vote. I've been reading articles about people who went to Democratic rallies and felt like the economic message didn't speak to them, and so they did not vote. And I also read about a lot of Black women who say, look, we vote for Democrats. We disagree with them on so many things, but we know at the end of the day, this is about the collective good. It's about something that's bigger than my one vote. So I wonder how you're all thinking about that, because, you know, people are still asking, you know, it's one thing to be a Republican and to support Republican policies, but to vote for a man who was convicted of sexual abuse, January 6th, separating families, the horrific racist things he continually says. I know there's a lot there, but I'm just wondering how you're all thinking about these issues. Melanie, what are your thoughts on that? When you look at the numbers, when you think about the people who did not vote, and then, you know, at the end of the day, why Trump got over 77 million votes?
Well, I want to look at it, the fact that he was elected once already. So I don't just look at it as what happened in 2024, but the fact that he was elected in 2016, the fact that he was able to continue to function in a way that, and I know that's not you, Rose, but how in the public sphere and media, he was able to continue down that path out of office, right? And through media, attention that he continuously got for 4 years after that, for him to lose and then do all the things. But at the end of the day, this country does not want a woman, let alone another Black person, you know? So that's, again, goes back to why. People say they voted for across the eggs. Really? Mm. I don't think so. I think that they didn't want this Black woman. I think she ran as successful a race as she could. There are a lot of things that need to be looked at on how the Democrats, and this is just my opinion, it is not my organizational opinion, I don't get into that, but from a partisan standpoint, I think that the Democrats have to do some soul searching about how what went wrong and how they managed, and there is a consistent group of folks that continues to get funded to these campaigns, consultant class, if you will, who, no matter what, can come back. And I think there's those kinds of things that have an impact on the results. At the same time, elections aren't every 4 years or every year. You see also where people are getting elected. So I think we have to also have that perspective about what's happening, and that those 3 million votes that you talk about meant that majority of people did not, in many places, the majority of people did not want the current occupant of the White House. So it's not that he had a mandate, although the destruction is real because of the 3 levels of government are not functioning as 3 equal branches of government. So it's also the system and structure that's really causing a lot of the pain that we're all going through right now. Mm-hmm. And whether or not there will be another election is still up in the air, I believe, based on some of the things that are happening, things that Judith talked about, as far as the systemic and structures that are under real threat in this country.
Adrian, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, one of the challenges that we continue to have in terms of making sure that we are educating and informing and mobilizing voters is, you know, not just the sort of apparatus to mobilize and turn folks out. I think that one of the things that we saw that we're pretty good at that, right? I think one of the challenges that is with us, has been with us, and will stay with us really is the ways in which people receive information and the kind of information that they are receiving. I can tell you that when we were doing focus groups last cycle and talking to voters, and even now as we do focus groups, one of the things that's really clear is that people are severely misinformed. And we know that a lot of that is because of the propaganda and mis and disinformation that comes across their social media feeds. And what that does is to cause people to say, well, I'm gonna step out. I'm not gonna participate because I saw this on my Instagram feed, or I saw this on TikTok and I don't know if I like that, or I disagree with that. And it's actually just misinformation. And so when we think about the folks who did not participate in last year's presidential election, we know that for many of them, it was simply because they were getting information that was intended to demobilize them, that was intended to assist in creating confusion within communities. And that certainly was true for Black communities, not just last cycle, but in 2020 and in 2016 as well, where Black communities were targeted with mis and disinformation, intentionally attempting to get them to stay out of the elections. And so I think that that is as we approach not just this year's elections, of which we have obviously two significant governor's races, but as we approach the midterms, this question of how are we communicating with people to make sure they are getting accurate information has to be at the very forefront of the conversation about what it means to re-engage those folks who decided to stay out last year and bring them back into the fold. We won't get them back into the fold if we can't disrupt what is a pretty serious disinformation machine that again demobilizes people. I also think that it is critical, and Melanie touched on this a bit, that Democrats get really clear about who their strategy for engaging their base, and I do mean engaging their base, and not just making decisions about the voters that they believe that they lost and that they can bring back into the fold, but really thinking about how they're engaging their base, because it is the loss of those voters, voters of color, right, sort of younger voters, key constituencies within the Democratic coalition who chose to sit out. And if Democrats cannot bring them back into the fold, then it is going to be a very long and dark winter for all of us. And that is critical, right, to preserving our democracy and sort of getting back on the right foot here, is making sure that we're bringing those folks back into the fold and not, suggesting that there are certain things that we can't talk about that might be more appealing to those voters, that we can only talk about the economy and we can't talk about the way that racism is showing up, that there's sort of this rise in white supremacy that people are terrified of, that people are terrified of hate crimes, that people are terrified of, being set back, not just a decade or two, but generations in terms of rights in this country, and that Democrats have to speak to that. And so I think that there's this sort of moment of, where decisions have to be made about how the base of the Democratic Party is gonna have to be engaged as we go forward.
And Adrian, those issues are getting so much attention again because of Zohran Mamdani's victory in the mayoral race in New York City.
Yeah.
Yes. So people are really talking about this. What does this say about the future of the Democratic Party? It's that constant question. We're going to be doing a show about that on Tuesday. Today, we are speaking with three Black women activists about this political moment, what effective activism and organizing looks like, and where we go from here. Melanie, I know we have to let you go. We have about a minute left. Thanks so much for taking the time. What are your thoughts about how to deal with the next 4 years? Because we have so much research here that we wanted to share with you all. I mean, just when you think about Medicaid cuts and how it affects the most vulnerable people in this country, 1 in 5 people on Medicaid are Black. 64% of Black moms who give birth in the United States do so with funding from Medicaid to cover costs of prenatal care. And we've done a lot of shows about Black infant mortality. It's the highest it's been in years. So what are your thoughts about, effective and organizing over the next 4 years? Because these cuts are going to have, just this alone is going to have major consequences.
Most definitely. The other reality is that Black women are losing jobs at a higher rate than any other demographic, Black people overall, but Black women on the last jobs report, showed that. So, and the impact on building wealth. So that's part of the strategy, going from within, to make sure that we are able to not just survive this moment, but still have the ability to thrive, still have the ability to find ways to have economic security, as well as the ability to build wealth, for our folks. And so that requires, one, continues to push back, right, on the current ugly bill that's on the Capitol Hill right now, where we know that the devastation, not just on Medicaid cuts, but on many elements around actually life and death when it comes to our health, when it comes to our economic security, education, being able to move, wanting to move money so that funding will be drained out of public schools, and on and on and on and on. And so right now, it's critical to focus on that. And a lot of us are working on pushing back on that bill, and doing those kinds of things. But it's also, I was in Atlanta a few weeks ago, where we hosted a Southern Regional Organizing convening, where we also know that sometimes you have to also look at other creative ways to turn that dollar over, to push back on companies like Target, with the Target boycott, because of the rollback on diversity, equity, and inclusion that's taking place. We can shop, we can spend our money where people who want to respect our dollars and respect our communities. And so those are some of the things that we have to continue to do. So organizing has to be in myriad ways, in a moment that is a tsunami of attacks, that we are going through. But I also have faith. And I know that for Black folks in this country, we've always had to have that to when it looks like, I said, the darkest before the dawn, and also challenge those who say they're allies, right? There are some things that continue to happen when you talk about that 92% versus majority of white women who voted for this current regime twice. There's also some reckoning that has to happen when we say we're allies. So, and you know, I've lived long enough now, a few decades around the sun, and know that this too shall pass, but it's not going to be easy.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Melanie, and thank you for your work.
And thank you, thank you. Good to hear everybody's voices,
You
and be in
too.
community. All right,
Thank you.
take
Take
care.
good care. That's Melanie Campbell, President and CEO of the National Coalition on Black Civic Participation and convener of the Black Women's Roundtable. She mentioned the Black workforce. And just to give you more information on this, in this ProPublica piece, dismissed by DEI, Trump's purge made Black women with stable federal jobs an easy target. The investigation found that Trump's dismantling of civil rights and inclusion programs in government are forcing out Black women who spent decades building a career of government service, only to see those careers shattered in a sudden purge. It's such an important piece at ProPublica. We're also joined today by Judith Brown Dianis, Executive Director of the Advancement Project. She leads their work in combating structural racism in education, voting, policing, criminal justice, and immigration. Adrian Shropshire is Executive Director of Black PAC and the affiliated nonpartisan Black Progressive Action Coalition. She also oversees Black PAC's research and political strategy. She began her political work as a community organizer in California. If you have any questions or comments for our guests, we're talking about this political moment, what effective activism and organizing looks like under a second Trump term, and where we go from here. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Judith, we recently did a show about the anniversary of the murder of George Floyd. And just reading about the work that you've done trying to combat racism in policing and criminal justice. You know, we talked about how, when you think about who went onto the streets, such a broad coalition of people. I remember doing shows about protests in California cities that I've never heard of. There were that many protests on the streets, and people were doing such important work, and the backlash came so swiftly and so you know, it was so strong. So what are your thoughts about what we saw at that moment and how that's connected to what we're seeing right now? What are your thoughts?
Sure. So I think, yes, we saw mass turnout after the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor that really did, it was everybody, right? I mean, you had Asian Americans for Black Lives Matter. You know, it really, it was great. It was important. It showed that people understood that what was being done in that moment was the dehumanization of a Black person again. And I think that we're seeing through lines of that now, because, and Adrian can probably tell you that in Los Angeles right now around the deportations, we are seeing solidarity between and across communities in this moment, because people understand, again, the dehumanization of anyone is a threat to all of us. And so I think this is where in this moment of again, leaning into solidarity around some shared values of like who we are as a country, shared values around, like I was speaking about the 14th Amendment, shared values of like who gets to be a citizen or belong in this country, right? Not just be a citizen, but our residents and our, and who are our neighbors that we are willing to protect. And I think that is the, that is kind of the organizing principles of this moment, right? And, you know, like you mentioned, the Black women who are being laid off. I live in the Washington, D.C. area. We have mostly a very strong Black middle class due to government jobs. People have worked their way up through the government, and we are going to be devastated. My county in particular, Prince George's County, which is a Black and Latino community mostly, we are going to be devastated. But I will tell you that people are coming together because they understand that we're all being attacked in this moment. And so that also means that we not only have to have solidarity in the protests, but also building out mutual aid networks, right? Like Black people understand how we have had to save ourselves in hard times. And so stepping up to make sure that your neighbor is okay, you know, like community fridges and Facebook pages that are, you put on, you know, you need something. We understand how we have to stand for each other, not just in protest, but in actually protecting and making sure that our material needs are met in the moment.
Hmm. What is it like being in DC during this time?
Oh, it's hard. It's hard. I mean, especially, you know, we have Advancement Project's offices downtown. And so there are many moments where we just close the office down, you know, because we know that there are people coming into town who are white supremacists, wow, who are looking for fights, who are who actually just have real hate in their hearts and in their actions. Mm-hmm. And you know, and I have staff who are people of color. I also have trans staff. I have queer staff. And so people don't feel safe on the streets of DC because the population has changed so much. We're getting an influx of Teslas and cyber trucks, and the people that come with them. And you know, being on the Capitol is hard too, because you have a lot of folks who feel very hopeless in that area, right? And so it's actually when we do the work outside of the Beltway that we feel most powerful, because we see people fighting back in real time in communities. Even in Maryland, you know, we have Casa de Maryland that's doing great work supporting people through deportations. And so that's the work, again, is like out in our communities. Being with each other and supporting each other and fighting back.
And Judith, I've also read that you've been dealing with very extreme heat. You had a heat index up to 110 degrees recently.
Yes. Wow. I mean, and this, you know, but this underscores like the issues that we're going to see popping up, right, when all these budget cuts come, right, mm-hmm. and when cities are not able to help people in the ways that they have in the past, and that's why we have to have mutual aid networks. But I also want to say that because, you know, when you get that kind of extreme heat, and we're going to see people who are going to suffer because they don't have air conditioning, they don't have appropriate housing, the houseless population that is growing in number, but is going to have to, you know, really kind of weather the climate change, right? Part of what we also have to be doing is fighting the fight at the state and city level. Because there's the way in which the dismantling of the federal government means that more money is going to the states, and the states will decide how that money gets allocated. And we have to understand that budgets are moral documents, and that we have to be organizing around that money and where it's going and what it's supporting, so that it's not supporting policing, it's not supporting increased policing and the use of police as immigration officers and all of those things, but actually that the state budgets are supporting us and protecting us and providing and meeting our material needs.
Mm. Well, it's devastating to hear that people on your staff do not feel safe in Washington, D.C. because of white supremacists who are coming to the city, but this is where we are right now, and people need to hear this. You know, Adrian, Judith was just talking about how budgets are moral documents, and we're about to do a segment in a few minutes about the California budget. It's got some really harsh cuts in it, affecting these hotlines that people call if they're under stress and they don't want to call 911. I mean, there's so many cuts in the budget that is going to, again, affect people in need and the most vulnerable. So it's not just at the federal level. We're seeing this at the state and local levels also.
Yeah, I was going to say that is it's the federal level, the state level, and in our city budgets. And I think that there is, you know, in this moment, and to Judith's point earlier, in this moment, it is the reason why it is so important for organizations and for communities to be organizing, to be engaging one another, not just on the advocacy front, which is obviously critical and important for communities to be coming together, advocating for what they need, you know, engaging with their local elected leaders, and making sure that you know, basic needs are being covered, that communities are able to thrive, even in this moment, that people feel like they're not just having to hunker down, because I think that does eliminate hope for people to feel like that basic survival is at stake. I think we need to be giving people hope in this moment. I think that there are ways that we can, but communities also need to be coming together and organizing in support of one another, and whether that is, you know, communities watching out for their neighbors as we, you know, resist these ICE raids, or if it's communities and community organizations and institutions making sure that basic needs are being met for folks in those neighborhoods, as we see, or in all of our neighborhoods, as we see budget cuts affecting, you know, everything from food service to education, et cetera. So this really is a moment. And again, getting back to our original, you know, sort of opening conversation about the importance of the work that's being done, both at the local level and at the national level, to make sure that our communities are fighting back, that they're showing resilience, that they are supporting one another and encouraging one another in this moment of, you know, fear for many people, that we are engaging in ways that will ultimately get us to the other side, and also preparing for what the other side, because this will come to an end. As Melanie Campbell said earlier, this too shall pass, and we need to make sure that our communities are intact and prepared to actually thrive on the other side.
Let's take one call before we go to our next segment. Let's hear from Eileen in Mountain View. Hi, Eileen.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. You know, I just haven't been able to understand what's going on now, because it seems to me that people who were understandably disaffected voted for Trump, but that Trump is, the people in Trump's administration are doing things that are not in their best interest. And I've just been reading this book by Annalee New. It's called Stories Are Weapons, in which she She says that some people in the administration believe that intelligence is directly proportional to skin tone, which I thought, you know, was an idea that went away a long, long time ago. But they're basing their actions on okay, all of these disaffected people, any poor people are not as bright, and we don't want to encourage them, and I'm horrified by the thought, but it does seem to explain what's happening. What do you do about that?
What do you do about that? Well, and then you talk about the administration trying to rewrite history, going after museums, ordering the renaming of monuments, on and on. Adrian, your thoughts?
I mean, we're seeing a retrenchment. We're seeing a return to, I mean, this idea of, you know, make America great again, I think has, you know, been many folks have said over and over again that this is about trying to take our country back to a period where open discrimination, where hostility toward people of color were acceptable and okay, and in fact, were policy. And I think that when we look at this, what the administration is doing, the executive orders that this president has put out, when we look at the ways that states are really, you know, sort of putting out retrograde policy against, you know, their own people, against the citizens and residents of states, the citizens of this country and residents of the state, we know that this is about taking us way back, not to the 1950s or 60s, but even before that. We're seeing things that just look like Jim Crow. They feel like Jim Crow. When Judith talks about her staff being afraid because white supremacists are coming into DC, that's everywhere. And this sort of, you know, having a government that is at war with its own people seems to be where we want to go. And we can see that with the militarization of the streets in Los Angeles. And so this is the thing that the American people have to push back against. I don't think that Americans actually want this. We can see it in the poll numbers. We can see it in the ways that people seem to be very confused right now about what's happening in this country. Because this is not what America, the Americans who supported, who voted for Donald Trump, I don't even think this is what they wanted. And so I think that you know, Americans ultimately, when confronted with historic moments like we are facing right now in this country, find the better angels in themselves. And I think that we will see that. I think that when we see elections come up this year and next year, that people will respond with the way that they are feeling right now, which is this is not the aspiration for this country that most Americans have. And I think that we'll see lots of pushback.
Adrian Shropshire is executive director of Black PAC and the affiliated nonpartisan Black Progressive Action Coalition. Judith Brown Dianis is executive director of the Advancement Project. Adrian and Judith, thank you so much for your work. Thanks for joining us, and we'd love to have you back.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. And coming up after a quick break, we'll continue talking about California's budget cuts. We'll specifically talk about the budget, which could eliminate funding for the Parents Anonymous California Parent and Youth Helpline, which has helped hundreds of thousands of people across the state. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.